From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Egyptians vote, Facebook backlash, Obama, Romney, and Bain capital, and commercial spaceflight goes high profile. In Egypt, first time ever, a free election for the country's leader. Here's Amr Moussa, a secular candidate, after he cast his ballot.
This is a great day, a big day, a decisive day, and I hope they will select correctly.
Morgan Stanley, NASDAQ, and the Facebook IPO under the microscope with charges of bumbling and favoritism. Analysts on CNBC laid out the bottom line.
The odds are stacked against you, and if you're not an insider on Wall Street, you are going to be left out in the cold, holding the bag. Exactly what happened here.
And a private cargo rocket blasts off from Cape Canaveral, making commercial space history.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. And launch of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket as NASA turns to the private sector to resupply the International Space Station.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Christopher Dickey of Newsweek and The Daily Beast, Diane Brady of Bloomberg Businessweek, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. Are you watching the elections in Egypt? Facebook wobbling? What's been your top story this week? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Diane Brady joins us from New York, senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Welcome back, Diane. Great to have you here.
Nice to be here.
And with us, Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief and Middle East editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, also in New York today. Welcome back, Chris Dickey.
Hey, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Diane, and Chris.
Christopher Dickey, first to you on Egypt. Here we are. It looks like it's going to be a runoff decided in June. What hath Egypt wrought here, Christopher?
Well, it really is a momentous period when you are moving the biggest country in the Arab world, the biggest population, towards some kind of democratic process. That's very, very good news. On the other hand, the two people who will be in that runoff, Ahmed Shafiq, who's very much associated with the Mubarak regime, and Mohamed Morsi, who is the candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood, show what kind of dichotomy exists in Egypt. And I can't imagine that whoever loses on June 17th is going to be either happy or conciliatory. I think we're probably in for a lot of unrest.
Here was another candidate. This is Hamdin Sabahi telling Euronews yesterday that he thought the first round of elections or the voting in the last couple of days looked pretty successful.
I think that so far the elections have been free from violence or fraud, and I think the irregularities are limited. So the elections in Egypt will not be invalidated. We hope that irregularities do not increase, and the voting that happened yesterday and today was orderly. In my opinion, the election has generally been free from blatant fraud.
Sabahi, a kind of dark horse candidate, Nasserite, socialist. So what does that suggest, Chris Dickey, that on the other side of this we're going to have the same sort of battle lines in Egypt? What difference will it make with an elected Muslim Brotherhood or former Mubarak, an Air Force general ally in there?
Well, this is an election that shows you the battle lines. And actually, the battle lines are even more complicated than that. This is the broad brush dichotomy. But, you know, it's an open question now. Where do the Salafists go, the other more extreme fundamentalists who were supporting another candidate? Do they just throw their backing now to the Muslim Brotherhood, with which they have ferocious differences? That's not clear at all. Shafiq is promising security, security, security. I think a lot of people hear that and think, oh, yes, right back to the Mubarak days, and not necessarily the happy part of the Mubarak days, the time when you could walk the streets in almost perfect security in Cairo. So I think that there's just a lot of pain and difficulty ahead of us, but it's great that there is this political process opening up. And the good news about Egypt is that even though they were kind of vestigial, Egypt has the institutions on which to build a democracy. It has a parliament. It has an independent judiciary. It has a constitution, although that's going to be rewritten. It has that history of attempts at democracy that goes back more than 100 years, even though it also has a very long history of tyranny.
And with what we've seen in the last couple of days, we heard the candidate saying there that the elections looked pretty good to him. Is that what you're hearing out of Cairo, that whatever the outcome, they seem to have pretty successfully pulled off the process?
Yeah, the process seems to be pretty well endorsed by everybody who was in it. But then again, we haven't come to the final showdown. You know, if I am sure that if Shafiq wins, you will hear from the Muslim Brothers that there was something deeply wrong with the process. And you may see Morsi win and the military starting to show its displeasure in any number of ways. So, you know, so far, so good. I mean, I think it's really good that and people were really excited to vote. I mean, a lot of women turned out to vote. Mm-hmm. And many places they outnumbered the men. People were excited. And we've seen this again and again in the Arab world, even when the political process goes astray afterwards, as it did in Iraq. When the Iraqis first had a chance to vote, they were like, wow, this is the most amazing thing we've ever done.
Yeah. And here's Egypt with it now. First time free elections for the leader, everybody loves to say, since the pharaohs. Diane Brady, speaking of pulling off process, Facebook did not look so great in this last week with its initial public offering, taking its stock public. All these charges of NASDAQ kind of messing up the technical side. Morgan Stanley, the bank that brought it out, brought the offering to the public. Having given special insight to some investors and not others. You got lawsuits now. What's up? And big losses in the stock. What is up with this, Diane?
I think my favorite quote is the gang that couldn't shoot straight. I think it starts with essentially greed, frankly, which is before this offer ever came to market, they increased the size of the shareholding, they increased the price. Essentially, they thought Facebook could do no wrong. And as you saw, not only was the listing essentially bungled on NASDAQ, I met one guy who thought he was buying at 37, and in fact, I think his order went through at 42. So there were a lot of problems there, but it really comes down to, I think, fairness. Retail investors, I think in this case, did in fact lose out. But mostly, I think it comes down to Facebook and some of the decisions that they and Morgan Stanley made, and there may be a day of reckoning with the lawsuits we're now seeing.
So, I mean, you heard, I mean, this was what, the biggest or one of the very biggest IPOs in history. And to think of it as botched in both kind of technical and maybe ethical terms is a bit mind-boggling. You heard that CNBC chatter going on there saying, look, this shows if you're not on the inside track, the stock market just doesn't work. I mean, is the indictment bigger than Facebook? Is it that big, Diane?
Well, you always hear this death of equities call and, you know, every few years, and this has certainly brought it on again. I don't think it's that the markets or IPOs are always skewed against retail investors. And by that, I mean, you know, you and I, not the big institutional investors. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, we had, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, the hoodie-wearing Facebook leader. He's made it very clear that he didn't particularly want to go public. This is a company that has sort of traded and been inflated in terms of these websites where you can trade private shares. So I think there was just a euphoria, first of all. And secondly, they just couldn't handle it. And at the last minute, they tried to ramp up the shares. Whether or not this affects the long-term health of Facebook, I'm not sure. But one of the big issues is that right before the IPO, essentially, their sales forecasts were lowered. And the big question is, did some of those big institutions know about that from these banks before the rest of us did? And that, I think, is going to be a real question because that's supposed to be how the market works. We all get information at the same time, and we can judge for ourselves. And this appears to be a case where that might not have happened.
And in one of the biggest business moves of all time, Jack Beatty, really interesting to see all that tarnish maybe and question around the Facebook IPO and the big banks in the same week that political contenders here, Obama and Romney above all, battling over the meaning of Mitt Romney's business experience. He comes out of that world and says, look, I've done it. I've done it great. I can do it for the U.S. economy. Barack Obama saying this week, that is not the most relevant experience, Mr. Romney, Governor Romney. Big back and forth on that, Jack.
Yes, and the president says this is not a distraction after Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, said it was on the on Meet the Press on Sunday. The president said this is what the campaign is about. And the president says, if Governor Romney has learned so much about the economy, why is it, to quote him, he's peddling the same bad ideas that brought our economy to the brink of collapse? Well, when you look in the Romney economic booklet, it's not really true that they're completely the same ideas. There are some new wrinkles. But basically, I think the president's charge is borne out. It is a program of tax cuts, especially for the wealthy, but also for corporations. and ambitious deregulation of environmental and banking and other regulation. So it's a sort of replay of Bush 2 and the last Clinton term where there was deregulation. That program led to the slowest job growth, really, in the Bush years since Herbert Hoover. So the president, I think, has some, I mean, beyond what the question of private equity, what did Mr. Romney learn? He seems not to have learned anything very new. Now, the new item, see, is controversial. John Boehner says it's dangerous. It's the idea of really confronting China over its currency and perhaps even precipitating a trade war with, as I say, Republicans having very cold feet about that one.
Diane Brady, there you are at Business Week. What have you made of this back and forth? Mitt Romney saying, look, I've got this business experience, therefore I should be the economy president. And Barack Obama saying, being president is about more than knowing how to make a profit.
Well, I mean, that you have seen these ads, certainly, with, you know, I saved a steel in a plant and then I killed a steel plant. So it, certainly they focused on the narrow experience of Bain Capital. But I think when you step back and look at the why is it that business supports Romney and why are they so nervous about Obama? I think it's partly it's not just making a profit. I think it's the conditions for business. It's this general sense of frostiness they felt from the Obama administration. So even though they might actually win on the fact that he made a profit, the reality is people want jobs, and I think there's actually more support out there for Romney than we might think.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, elections in Egypt, Facebook backlash, a new space shot, and Obama and Romney battle over who's better to guide the economy. Diane Brady is with us today from Bloomberg Businessweek, senior editor there. Christopher Dickey joins us, Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go right to our listeners. Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. It seems to me that both here in the States with the IPO, Romney's equity firm, and in Europe with the issue of financial discipline and versus stimulus, mm-hmm. we're all confronting all together the issue is, is money created, are the financial institutions out there to support the economy of the people, or are people out there to, on behalf of the financial institutions, money, and the equity funds? And I've got an MBA, and I'm certainly for discipline and rigor, mm-hmm. but it seems like the argument that Obama and Romney are going to have, and we have in Europe, is the issue of which one comes first, the people or money?
Michael, let us pick that straight up. Christopher Dickey, that's been right at the forefront, in a way, of the elections recently in Europe, the backlash there against austerity, more effort this week to get on top of it. But what about this bigger question of who's working for whom here, and are financial institutions working for the general public, Christopher?
Well, you know, I think there's a general hostility in a lot of Europe to money. You know, we've seen it a little bit, quite a bit, in fact, with Occupy Wall Street and with the arguments about the 1%. But in France, where I live, you have a society that's deeply suspicious of anybody who gets rich, and it's one of the reasons that people in France traditionally try desperately to hide the fact that they're rich. People don't even drive red cars in Paris. You don't want to stand out, and it's not only because of the tax that is likely to be imposed on you, but because generally the society doesn't support it. So when you then get into issues of banks, you don't get a lot of public sympathy for banks where you know, everybody seems to be rich and they must have done something wrong. Even when they haven't done anything wrong, they're suspected of some kind of criminal or at least unethical activity in a world where everything is supposed to be a zero-sum game.
Yeah,
politically.
Diane Brady, I mean, here we are. You hear here's an MBA calling in and saying, you know, I want discipline. I want an economy that works well. But is this setup, the institutional setup, really working these days? And he's pointing right across the board.
Well, there's so many villains in these dramas of the past few years, and the truth is you cannot have irresponsible borrowers without irresponsible lenders. We're seeing that with the banks now in Europe. And I think more broadly, Americans in particular will put up with a lot if they feel the playing field is fair. And I think what has changed, certainly since the crisis, is a sense that it is not fair. And that's why you're seeing this fixation on the bankers, on the top 1%. There's a sense that the game is somehow rigged against you. And I don't think, certainly we're different from France. We like our red cars. We like our billionaires. But we like to know we can all get there, too. And I think that's what's changed.
Mitt Romney, interesting moment. But he's saying, you know, look, my business experience is the way. President Obama doesn't have it. He talked with Time Magazine's Mark Halperin on Wednesday. His first interview since his record at Bain Capital became a campaign focus, insisting that his private sector experience is an asset when it comes to the issues of the economy.
For someone who spent their life in the economy, they understand how that works. And it's very clear by virtue of the president's record that he does not. And he is struggling. I mean, look at him right now. He just doesn't have a clue what to do to get this economy going. I do. I laid out a 59-step plan that encompasses a whole series of efforts that will together get this economy going and put people back to work.
Mitt Romney, I've got the experience and I've got a 59-step plan. At a campaign rally in Des Moines yesterday, President Obama said Romney has no new ideas on how to revive the economy.
He says this gives him a special understanding of what it takes to create jobs and grow the economy. Even if he's unable to offer a single new idea about how to do that, no matter how many times he's asked about it, he says he knows how to do it.
So there's how it's laid out this week. Jerry is in Iowa, Iowa City. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I have a question. We had another president who was a great businessman, maybe even a greater businessman than Romney, who was a great conservative and, in fact, maybe the original neocon, Herbert Hoover. And I'm just wondering why the Obama campaign hasn't linked Romney more to Herbert Hoover and his experiences when he came to the presidency and led us to the Depression than they have.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Jack Beatty, the sort of Obama corner seemed not entirely clear this week. Maybe his campaign, but not his corner, about what was fair game here. You had all this heat on, as you say, the Newark Mayor Cory Booker when he came out and said that attack ads from the Romney camp and from the Obama camp made him sick. What's fair game here, Jack?
Well, we're going to see, and I think those who say it's going to be a very dirty campaign are certainly right. I mean, there's going to be lots of talk about discipline. Going to be lots of undisciplined money with the super PACs on either side firing away, perhaps below the belt.
But this wasn't some distant super PAC. This was Cory Booker, who's seen as a stand-in for Obama.
That's right. That's right. Well, of course, the Reverend Wright business from last week, that was a super PAC. So, and perhaps a straw in the wind. But on this question of Herbert Hoover, you know, it's sort of unfair to Mr. Hoover. He was, in fact, one of the world's premier businessmen. He was he was the man who almost single-handedly fed Europe, and both before at the beginning of World War One and at the end. And it was his misfortune to be president at a time of the crash and what followed. And it's very hard to really blame what happened, the Depression, on him. True, he didn't have a personality like FDR, but on the other hand, it did take FDR most of a decade to get out of the Depression, and it took a war.
Yeah, let's go to Jackie in Brattleboro, Vermont, if we can. Jackie, thanks for calling. I think we've got you here. You're on the air.
Hi. This is Jackie from Brattleboro. I don't know if
you're on, Jackie.
Said my name.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Listen, I'm really tired of these folks pulling what I'm starting to think of as the money card. You know, it's not that we don't like money, and it's not that we don't like, you know, people who have money. Some of my best friends are very, very rich, and in my family, too. All of those of us who haven't dedicated our lives to, you know, accumulating money, all that we want is a fair shake. We just want to be paid a living wage for making the money that they're accumulating at the top. We don't want them to just skim off all the cream and leave us with milk powder. I'm just tired of hearing that people who protest against this don't like money and are prejudiced against people who have money.
Yeah, Jackie, I appreciate your call. I mean, Chris Dickey, look on both sides of the pond here in the sort of tenor of the conversation. You've seen it hot in Europe lately, and they're up against a tough picture that may hit the president's reelection effort as well. Then on this side, and this whole, it's kind of back to the same question, Chris, but how these attitudes compare Europe, the U.S., and here's Jackie, just a fair shake, please.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, as I look at this situation in the United States, for instance, one of the things that I find disturbing is that I know many businessmen. I do have lots of rich friends, and they are sitting on huge amounts of cash, which they are not spending. If they were spending it, there would be a lot more jobs, but they're not spending it. They're not investing it. They're saying, we don't want these regulations. We don't trust Obama. So in a sense, you know, if Romney comes in and they feel confident that he's a good guy and they start spending the billions they're sitting on, the economy will improve. But Romney, of course, isn't going to say that with his 59-point plan. I'd like my friends to start spending the money they're not. In Europe, you know, it's not just a question of attitudes toward money. I mean, we really are looking at a potentially disastrous situation in Europe. Greek elections are coming up on the 17th of June. It looks very likely that the Greeks will elect a far-left government that wants to stay in the euro, it says, but doesn't want to obey any of the rules whatsoever that are part of that package. And if and when that happens, you know, there's a lot of speculation about the impact. Nobody really knows, but I'm sure a lot of the big interests, people like the IMF, the Christine Lagarde, who I've talked to many times, you know, they were blindsided by Lehman Brothers in 2008 because somebody thought that you could have Lehman Brothers go down and it would all somehow be controlled. Well, Lehman Brothers will look like very small potatoes compared to a default by Greece. Mm.
Diane, let's look at both sides of that. First, Chris Dickey's rich friends who are sitting on their money. Maybe they're not spending it because there's not consumer demand out there because consumers don't have the cash to pump it up. And then what about if Europe, if it goes, if it blows, what about the impact here? Both sides of that, Diane.
Well, I certainly think that what business likes is predictability, and that's what you do not have at the moment, is a sense of if you make an investment, it's going to be a good investment, you know, 3-5 more years from now. But
hey, but we had the Bush years and talk about predictability, it all blew up. That was...
Well, that was not, you know, what I think the question right now is responsibility versus opportunity. And I think one thing that people feel a great lack of is a sense of inspiration. There is a lot of pessimism on the ground, but in fact, employers have been hiring in the private sector, not so much in the public sector here. And there is a recognition, at least, that the top has not been paying its fair percentage, whether it's corporate taxes or personal taxes. With regard to Europe, I think that it's such a mess. In fact, our cover this week, I think, is banghead here, but the euro crisis, because it has never made sense from the beginning, obviously. You're seeing all these old stereotypes come out, the vain French, of which Chris is not one, of course, but you just all these stereotypes with regard to Germany and Greece. And I think that people over here are at least recognizing the fact that you have to allow Greece some degree of growth for that, for the population to go forward. But it looks like people are now talking about them exiting the currency. And I'm sure Chris can speak to this as well. That is seen on both sides of the Atlantic as a potential disaster for business because of the ripple effect. And just because, you know, basically, if you talk about a lack of predictability and security, that really does set us in a new direction.
Markets all over the place and largely down in the last week and a half or more over exactly that fear. I mean, if it goes further in that direction, Diane, how much is at risk here?
Well, you know, the reality for Greece is, I think when they take a cold, hard look at it, going to the drachma puts them in a worse situation. When you look at their, first of all, they import twice as much as they export. And when I look at their exports, they really do look circa 1950. It's olive oil, cotton. I mean, even if it's aluminum, it's stuff they import and then export again. But more broadly, I think the question is, you know, what happens to this currency? What happens to all the banks that essentially have taken a stake in Southern Europe in general? And it's just a general sense out there that, you know, when you look at the financial picture, it's just so insecure, and you're getting so much kind of bickering out of Europe right now that it just it exacerbates the fear factor, and we're pretty tenuous ourselves over here. So I think that's, we're not on as firm a footing with our own economy, and I just think it makes things worse.
With plenty of potential blowback for the Obama reelection campaign, if it should knock the economy back here, and for the economy itself, Fort Jackson, South Carolina, Sean's calling. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see, Sean?
Well, you know, my perspective is I grew up as an inner-city L.A. kid, right in the middle of a lot of economic challenges. In spite of that, through a lot of work, I've had the opportunity to also live in Greenwich, Connecticut, work as a private client advisor for these 1%ers. From my vantage point, I think Romney has we have a huge opportunity here with Romney simply because he's been successful both as a governor and private sector. Additionally, it appears to me, again, having worked as not only a private client advisor for and doing the taxes for a lot of these significantly established families, I work now as a financial counselor for the 99%ers.
Okay.
Oftentimes below.
Yeah.
And in that view, what I find is that those who are the 1%ers, statistically speaking, of my clients I've served, were normal people who just worked hard, set aside, they lived very frugally, and got to other places, whereas the others that I serve as a financial counselor that aren't doing as well, historically, typically from family dynamics, they get caught up early on and don't accomplish big goals because they get caught up in a lot of this consumer spending that I don't see my 1% of clients doing in their earlier ages.
But the 1%, that would include Mitt Romney and many others. But, I mean, there's his dad, head of American Motors and, wealthy family from the start. Not exactly bootstraps, Sean.
Of those folks, you look at the statistics behind it, and most of those people are self-made. The majority of that population is a self-made millionaire.
Sean, I appreciate your call. We got that right there. Jack Meadey, I mean, that attitude is still out there in this country. Maybe it's divided now. I don't know. But you've certainly got people in the polls saying, look, that's what we want. We want Romney to sort of open up the field, give us a shot, put that American energy to work. Everything will be better.
Yes, and polls from NBC this week show Romney with a 58-32% lead among white voters who identify as struggling economically. Biggest lead he's had there. So, and Obama's rating is 43% general approval on the economy, the worst rating he's had in some time. So, yes, there's a tremendous opening for the Romney story. I guess the question is, and it's the one raised by the president, does that equip him with the intellectual and moral wherewithal to be a successful president? And by moral, I mean empathy. Is this a man who feels the dilemmas of ordinary people or who has any idea of them? And I think the president's campaign is going to hit that again and again, that yes, he's been successful, but one downside of that success is he doesn't have much sympathy with people who aren't.
But, Jack, you can imagine people looking at that, and maybe it's that 58% of struggling white voters you're talking about saying, I don't know, intellectual, moral wherewithal, never mind. Just crank up the economy and we'll be fine, Jack.
Yes, that seems to be the feeling. And I thought Chris Dickey's point about Romney's friends will start spending once he's president, maybe there's a kind of implicit capital strike going on where they're holding on to their money and waiting. But I really think people who say that lack of demand is the problem. I mean, Romney's people could cut taxes 25%. He wants to do that for corporations on day one. He could submit that bill and they could get more cash and just sit on it too, because there isn't the demand from the 99%.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, an apparent breakthrough in the 33-year-old mystery of Eitan Peitz, the first missing child on a milk carton. New York police arrested a man, Pedro Hernandez, who confessed to strangling the boy, we're told, who had vanished on the way to the bus stop. Here's Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly.
Hernandez described to the detectives how he lured young Eitan from the school bus stop at West Broadway and Prince Street. with the promise of a soda.
A guilty verdict for Rutgers student Darun Ravi in the cyberbullying case before the suicide of his gay roommate Tyler Clementi. Judge Glenn Berman sentenced Ravi to 30 days in jail, 300 hours of community service.
I do not believe he hated Tyler Clementi. He had no reason to. But I do believe he acted out of colossal insensitivity.
Could have had years in prison. And Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees died at 62 after a long battle with cancer. The Bee Gees ruled the disco dance floors with hits like 1977, Stayin' Alive. Wayback Machine and a sweet voice. Christopher Dickey is with us, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek, The Daily Beast. Diane Brady's here from Bloomberg Businessweek and our own Jack Beatty. We've got a little sound here, that privately built Dragon space capsule, just a few meters as we speak at this moment from the International Space Station, we're told, moving in toward that docking. Here's NASA commentator Josh Brierley on NASA TV describing the preparations on the space station.
The crew on board getting everything set up in the robotic workstation in the cupola. Don Pettit, Andre Kuipers, and Joe Acaba are having a quick chat on board, making sure that everybody's on the same page and ready to support this morning's activities.
Don Brady, give us a read on that. I mean, space is always exciting. There's nothing going on here that hasn't gone on for years in government-sponsored flight. Is this just PR? What's the big hubba-hubba about the commercial entry here?
I think this is exciting. And part of what's exciting is who's behind it. I mean, this is a guy named Elon Musk. He is the co-founder of PayPal. And people also know him as the guy behind Tesla, that hybrid roadster we're all supposed to be paying
electronic,
the big bucks
yep,
for.
Yep.
But, I mean, essentially, I think that this is a man who initially wanted to go to Mars. It's not quite there yet. But, you know, I think it's just a great success story for him. And also the fact that, frankly, he's dreaming big. And now we've got a, you know, private sector initiative to go into space. I think that really does engage people because it's been many, many years since we've been excited about space. We have not been hearing a lot about it.
Right. Granted, for him, yeah, incredible. And he's got a billion-plus contract that he will apparently ink if this all goes according to plan. But for space, does it matter? I mean, is there some notion that there's a huge amount of private sector energy that's going to take us to do amazing things in space? Or is this just nice contracts for taking stuff up and down to the space station?
I think certainly in his case, his aspirations are bigger, which I think is something that excites people. And the other reality is that he has done this for a fraction of what NASA normally spends. And I think that's also interesting to people that when you look at the tens of billions of dollars that have gone into the program, and even, you know, Newt Gingrich and I don't agree on a lot of things, but certainly when it comes to, you know, what's happened in space and not even having manned vehicles, I mean, I think that people want to be engaged and excited and look at the potential, not just resource potential or space station. They want to, you know, perhaps go further, and that's certainly something Elon Musk has talked about. And so this is a first step. But I think what's exciting is that he certainly wants to do much more.
And as we speak, news in high, high above northwestern Australia, that robotic arm from the International Space Station has grabbed the cargo capsule that was floating, 10 meters or something away. Don Pettit there, the NASA astronaut operating the robotic arm, saying, looks like we've got a dragon by the tail. Dragon, the name of that space capsule. Bring us right down to Earth, Chris Dickey, and this story about the Pakistani doctor who was involved with the U.S. in trying to get a bead on where Osama bin Laden was, government surgeon up in the Khyber Agency along the border with Afghanistan, now convicted of treason for using a vaccination drive to try to gather DNA samples from that compound. I guess he didn't actually get the samples, but anyway, they're throwing him in prison for a long time, it looks like. What is going on here, Chris?
The Pakistanis were humiliated by the killing of Osama bin Laden, by the fact that he was hiding out within earshot of a military academy of the equivalent of West Point in Pakistan, by the breach of their sovereignty, by what it revealed about the lack of cooperation with the United States, the questions it raised about cooperation with al-Qaeda. For all those reasons, they were humiliated. And somebody has to pay. They're not going to put Obama on trial. They're not going to get any of the seals. So here is this Pakistani citizen who cooperated in some what was actually not a very significant way, and he's paying the price.
But, I mean, down the road, U.S. tries to get cooperation. Aren't people going to think about, you know, Shakil Afridi sitting in a Pakistani prison for 33 years? Who's going to want to get in there? Now the Senate panel is saying they're going to cut Pakistan's aid by $33 million. It's a billion-dollar aid package. Does that really matter?
Yeah, I think it matters. I mean, you know, it's always a challenge to get people to cooperate in these pursuits of terrorists. Sometimes they're related to the terrorists. Sometimes they believe in the same things. And sometimes they just want money. You know, this is a disincentive to cooperate. But on the other hand, you know, I think anybody who would do this kind of thing in the future would want to cut a deal, a pretty clear deal with the CIA so they could get out and take advantage of whatever gains they made from it.
It's interesting they didn't take this or get this doctor out. John McCain yesterday, Senator, was among many who were hot under the collar about the arrest and conviction of this doctor for aiding the effort to find and to get Osama bin Laden.
All of us are outraged at the imprisonment and sentence of some 33 years, virtually a death sentence, to the doctor in Pakistan who was instrumental, not on purpose, but was instrumental and completely innocent of any wrongdoing, was instrumental in the removal of Osama bin Laden.
Jack Beatty, what do you see as the moral of this story? The doctor headed into prison 33 years.
Oh, it's an ugly business, and I think it's a paradigm of this, quote, alliance we have with Pakistan. It's an alliance in name only, and continually we don't face up to, you know, how far our real interests diverge, interests in Afghanistan notably. And so this just goes on. You know, there's a this fallout from this whole business that's unfortunate and really tragic. The New York Times has reported, as well as the L.A. Times, on the trouble that this has created with vaccination programs, notably for polio. The doctor was involved in a fake vaccination program. Well, these are now effectively stopped, or at least considerably impeded, in the tribal areas because of this aura of CIA involvement. And the result is that children who could be saved will be stricken with various diseases, including polio.
But once you get out there and, you know, you start intervening and, wow, that's not a good that's not a good side effect here. Abed in Des Moines, Iowa. Abed, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hello, sir. What do you think?
I think that the doctor's case in Pakistan, how is that different from Jonathan Pollard giving secrets to Israel and then convicted for treason and put in jail for 20 years? I mean, it's the same case.
Chris Dickey, what do you say?
Well, you know, there are many differences, but I think it comes down to a question in Pakistan. I think the issue is really one of national pride, and that was not the issue in the Pollard case. You know, listening to McCain, I was thinking to myself, what a bad idea this is for him to come out and make these kinds of statements. It's not going to help Dr. Afridi. The $33 million being taken away is not going to help him. Because what does all that say to the Pakistanis, who are very proud people? It says, you guys don't know what you're doing. You have to do things the way we want you to do them. And that's not at all helpful for the man in question. You know, on the other, the Pakistanis may not be great allies, but they do work with us on a lot of things. We can't do things that we want to do in Southwest Asia without extensive Pakistani cooperation. So all this kind of grumbling and saying they're really the enemies, they're the real problem. There certainly are big issues, but to say they're just hopeless and that we should turn our backs on them is to raise a whole new group of issues that I think are very, very dangerous indeed.
Yeah. I mean, meanwhile, all those supply lines in through Pakistan not open to the U.S. Tavish in Colchester, Vermont. Tavish, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question for Christopher Dickey and a wider question for your other guests. Mm-hmm. I was hoping to get Mr. Dickey's opinion on the expanded drone strikes in Yemen as well as the casualties that U.S. military advisors took. And I was hoping for a greater discussion on the real differences in foreign policy between Obama and Mitt Romney. I know that this is going to be a referendum more on the economy, but I'm just curious how Mitt Romney can tack more to the right in terms of his global war on terror, and whether generally they view the expanded presence of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula as an effect of CIA drone strikes or just people moving away from Pakistan. Thank you.
Thank you, Tavish. Christopher, what about the drone strike, U.S. drone strikes, Yemen, and the bigger picture? You know, big difference in foreign policy or not?
Well, you know, Obama is what you might call a secret war monger. He
not
came
so
in,
secret.
Yeah, but not fully acknowledged
mm-hmm.
either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he came in and he understood one very big problem, which was that if you think you're going to fight terrorism by going and conquering and occupying other countries, no matter what your stated motives are, the people there are going to hate you. That has always been the tradition. People hate foreign powers that are perceived as occupiers. And no matter how we tried to present it, that's the way we were perceived in Iraq. That's the way we are perceived in Afghanistan. So he wanted to get out of there. On the other hand, no American president is going to allow groups like al-Qaeda to organize plot attacks and try and carry them out from bases that are immune to attack. So he started to rely more and more, I mean hugely, on these drone strikes. Is there a killing of civilians with these drone strikes? Yes. And I think actually it's going to get worse. We have a big piece coming out in Newsweek by Danny Kleidman on Monday. Mm. And, you know, I think one of the issues looking at these drone strikes, and I think one of the issues that's developing is that the expansion of al-Qaeda's territory and control in Yemen has taken us out of the range of problems that can be solved, if you will, by drone strikes. Are we going to put boots on the ground again? I know that Obama's desperate not to do that, but how do you address it? The reason that that al-Qaeda was able to expand its presence so much in Yemen was not a result of the drone strikes. That I think, probably kept them in check to some extent. It was the result of the near collapse of the Yemeni government and the old tribal resentments and divisions. Yemen's a very, very a complicated patchwork quilt of tribal allegiances.
It was interesting. And, oh, sorry, Chris.
No, and al-Qaeda was able to exploit that situation.
It was interesting this week that you had Colin Powell back on the scene. He's out and about, Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, endorsed Obama in the 08 campaign, has not endorsed a candidate this election, interesting in itself, at least not yet. But he was on MSNBC's Morning Joe on Wednesday, took a swipe. Here's Colin Powell at Mitt Romney's foreign policy statements on the campaign trail.
Well, when Governor Romney not too long ago said, you know, the Russian Federation is our number one geostrategic threat. Well, come on, Mitt, think. It isn't the case. And I don't know whether Mitt really feels that or whether
or
it was
told
something.
Him to say it?
I don't know.
What?
I don't know. I mean, it's been catching a lot of heck from the more regular GOP foreign affairs community. We're kind of taken aback by it.
Colin Powell weighing in on foreign policy there, and not so warmly toward Mitt Romney, but then he hasn't committed in this election. I want to get a little bit more Mitt Romney. He was out this week unveiling his plans for what he called unprecedented education reforms, gave a speech at the Chamber of Commerce in Washington on Wednesday, outlined his proposal, which includes expanding parental choice in which schools a whole lot of students can attend.
So as president, I'm going to give the parents of every low-income and special needs student the chance to choose where their child goes to school. For the first time in history, federal education funds will be linked to the student so that parents can send their child to any public or charter school of their choice.
Jack Beatty, that's actually a big deal. You know, any student with any kind of federal support, and that's a lot of low-income students in this country getting subsidized breakfasts and the rest, take that government funding and go to any school they choose with it. What do you think, Jack?
Well, it is a big deal, and it is calculated to appeal to people who are feel trapped in urban school systems where their children are failing. And now, whether that will make any difference for him electorally, I don't know. But this is one of his big new ideas, and the sort of hidden agenda of it, of course, it's not so hidden, it comes out in the speech, is, you know, that this is a way of stripping power from the, quote, union bosses, the union bosses being the teachers' union. And he posits a conflict of interest between what they want, teachers' unions want, and what children want. And he's saying, we're not going to be held back by that, and we're going to even allow some of this money to go to private schools.
Some, or just anybody who wanted to take it there. Interesting that he gave that speech at the Chamber of Commerce, Diane Brady. Is that venue one of particular interest in American education policy?
Well, I do think he's suggesting that market forces are going to solve our education problems. The same way I think that teachers are not the villains necessarily. I also don't think that charter schools are the savior, especially when you're looking at what actually exists in a lot of these cities in terms of options. But I think more broadly in terms of the differences we're seeing both on education, foreign policy, is there is this general belief, whether or not, he has looked to Russia, there's a general belief in the Romney camp that market forces will solve all. You certainly see it with their attitude toward trade deals. Obama has not been that warm toward trade deals, even though three of them squeaked through under his watch. And I think that's where a lot of people are going to really, you know, take a look. Do they believe the markets are fair? Do they believe the markets will benefit them? If they do, then maybe they will go with Romney.
Diane Brady, senior editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Diane, it's always great to have you. Thank you for joining us this week, Diane.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
Chris Dickey, 10 seconds in a word. Progress on Iran and the nuclear front or just talk?
Talking is progress.
We'll take that for now and watch that space. Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Wonderful to have you. Thanks very much for being with us, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, always great to have you, my friend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And same to you, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.